How can believers be in the world but not of the world? Welcome to The Good Word. My name is Mathilde Frey and I'm professor of theology at Walla Walla University. I'm your host today's lesson on Daniel chapter 6. I'm together here today with Jody Washburn and Dave Thomas, both professors of Walla Walla University. This time we study Daniel chapter 6, the well-known story about Daniel being thrown into the lion's den. What happened? Where are we in time? And why had Daniel no other chance than to come to that point where he went into the lion's den? Did he have other opportunities where we want to know about his prayer life, why he did it, what was the meaning of it? So there are these officials who go against Daniel.
You know, Mathilde, when you ask those questions, the first thing that comes to my mind is jealousy. Mm. You think of this. Here's Daniel now, who is an old man. He's a remainder from the previous kingdom, and he has prominence in the new kingdom. Mm-hmm. And so the people in the new kingdom are angry and jealous, and they look for a case against him. And of course, the major piece of this is that they find no reason to fault him except for the fact that he is religious. Mm-hmm. He has religion that's somewhat different, and it involves praying toward Jerusalem.
It strikes me when I read this story. The jealousy aspect, I think, is something that's very easy to identify with. I think we can all look back in our lives and see times when we had a twinge of jealousy. But the other thing that...
This was more than a twinge.
This is more than a twinge. I'm not saying we identify totally, but I think there are hints of identification. And the other thing that I think... Maybe I should speak only for myself, but I also... I find it easy to identify with the king. Also, he's not the one who initiated this law. Everyone should worship only him, right? But how easily
he was willing to
go down that road. And I just think, you know, how easy is it when flattered or when given a way to make myself the center of something to not to be enough hesitation. So I find it easy to identify with multiple of these mechanisms that are at work. These are human-to-human mechanisms, yes, that are part of how we interact.
Was this an era where the divinity was presumed to be connected to the king?
It was,
yes.
Oh, so this would not have been totally outlandish then for him to be asking people to worship him?
No, yes. the only difference here would be the only worship.
Oh, the only king.
Instead of among, right? Am I reading that correctly? That the significance here wouldn't be that they were worshiping the king, but that they were worshiping only him.
I was reading it more in the sense that they were requiring people to not make requests to any other deity, but to the king. It's not necessarily
not just worship,
like, you know, devotion in terms of worship religiously, but to bring their requests
king. So when Daniel is praying, making requests of God, that's what got him in trouble.
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. So we are in the time of the first year when Babylon has transferred to the Medo-Persian emperors. The great king is Cyrus. But in chapter 6, we have Darius the Mede mentioned. He's mentioned at the end of chapter 5 and now at the beginning of chapter 6. Mm-hmm. We don't know much about this name, Darius, specifically, like who he was in the history of the Babylonian kings. Mm-hmm. It seems that he could be a king placed into Babylon by Cyrus directly because he was maybe the one who was directly in charge and was something like a co-king or co-regent.
Who didn't reign for very long. I mean, he never became prominent like Cyrus, in other words.
No, he didn't. We don't know anything of him outside of the Bible. Hmm. We know him only in the Bible by this name, Cyrus the Mede. And there are arguments that go around about this and debates.
You mean Darius the Mede, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So
he's a new ruler, and he has taken over Babylon, and he, again, his basic idea is he needs to set up the government.
Yeah, and he wants to establish his authority.
Yes, and he does that in the first verses, those 100 satraps and the administrators, mm-hmm. and then the three on top and above them, then it was to be Daniel.
So basically the link, because if we review just briefly, the Babylonian, like the Assyrian Empire, had displaced people and brought them to Mesopotamia. And now the Persian Empire is doing the opposite. We read in Ezra, the Cyrus Cylinder, like allowing people to return, build temples for their gods. So it's the opposite. And this sense of, so the satrapies would have been all these huge regions all over the empire. Mm-hmm. So it was almost like between the leaders of the satrapies and the king, there would be a middle person.
Yes.
Is that where Daniel would fit?
Yeah, seems like it.
Quite prominent.
He would be the prime minister of the entire empire in the end. Yes, yeah. Also, it's interesting that that Cyrus did not destroy the city of Babylon or any of the buildings that mm-hmm. Nebuchadnezzar had set up. They take it over.
Yeah.
And in some historical records, it seems that also the administrators stay in their places and taken over.
Mm. Yeah.
So it's a kind of like almost peaceful flow of power.
And it's a different paradigm.
Yes.
Like the idea that the easiest way to collect taxes in a huge empire is to have a functioning local framework in each place.
And that is why probably Daniel is still in there too.
Mm. Hmm.
Because he's taken over. But yet, chapter 6 says he stands out still mm-hmm. among all of the others. Yeah.
So the king falls for their new rule without realizing what the unintended consequences were going to be.
Yes. How easy is that? Not to think of implications for other people.
I heard a wonderful talk about unintended consequences, you know. That's one of the big struggles in life. You try and make a decision and then realize that your decision had consequences you never envisioned, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not a major theme here. I've often wondered why Daniel didn't just pray in secret after this.
Yes.
I think I would have been tempted to do that.
Me too. Couldn't you?
At least for the 30 days.
Yeah, for the 30 days. And how easy is it to think, because again, going back to big themes that are being wrestled with in the exile and post-exilic period, one of the themes is that God is no longer only resident in the Jerusalem temple, but now God is where the people are, right? Right. In Ezekiel, he goes east toward Babylon in those visions, and the idea that you can pray toward Israel and be acknowledging your recognition of Yahweh as the God of Israel. But couldn't you do that just the same with your curtains closed? I mean, that's the question I think the reader is led to ask. Reading this story.
But it doesn't give us a clue as to why he didn't go in private, right?
He went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened toward Jerusalem. Maybe they didn't have curtains.
But he went there to pray.
To pray, but, as was his custom, three times a day.
But what about if we find out what is the reason for his prayer? Because he has done it this way as his custom, all his life already. It is not a prayer that is personal between me and God, like when Jesus points to it and says, go into your
room closet,
and close the door. It is a different kind of prayer that we see here. And we need to see what he's doing when he's praying toward Jerusalem. He's responding to the other prayer of King Solomon when he inaugurated the temple and prayed for that time when God's people will be
restored
in captivity.
Yeah.
And when they pray toward this city and this house
that bears your name, then you will hear.
Then you will hear. And he asks, please forgive. He asks in advance, please forgive. Daniel will pray for forgiveness in chapter 9.
Yes.
The big prayer.
Yeah, so his prayer is for the restoration of the, yes, the reactivation of the covenant.
So is he maybe doing all his life in this kind of way of prayer? Is he doing his own way of resisting the king's empire because he longs for the restoration of Israel? And he openly does that all his life.
That just
he
adds,
has done it.
It adds
this is
more.
Not a new situation for him.
I wonder if he prayed out loud.
Yeah. So he has knelt and prayed all his life already and resisted the empire of Babylon.
Yeah. And it highlights the juxtaposition then with those lines about him faithfully serving the king, being the most trusted officer. You know, there's a balance or a a contrast being drawn.
Now, Nebuchadnezzar could have done that long ago already to throw him out.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, because of his prayer, you mean?
Because he
Well, and because of the messages of the interpretations of the dreams, yeah.
Because he is one of the people who resists the Babylonian oppression.
Yeah.
By praying openly.
So it's always been an open protest against the empire.
Mm-hmm.
And so the spies see him.
They do.
And I've always thought that the king was a little bit disappointed when they brought Daniel in there and said, here's the guy now. Isn't that what the text says?
Yeah. But so I was thinking in this lesson, how do we, in our lives, I think a question that you asked the week before, how do we set our lives as a stand against force that is clearly going against God's way of how to deal with God's children, with God's people, no matter who they are.
Mm-hmm.
Daniel does it in his way through this kind of prayer. Yeah. The three friends did it by standing when the others fell down before the king.
Yeah,
so I come back to your question, Jody.
I don't think there's an easy answer to that. I think a lot of that is determined by circumstance, where you are in the moment. I mean, I think of that man in Tiananmen Square who withstood the tank. That was a moment in history, see?
Yes.
You think of Martin Luther King Jr., he had a moment in history. So I think of that one you mentioned from Russia here.
Yeah, someone standing up.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, despite the consequences.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's almost like, as readers, everything in us almost wants Daniel to protect himself because it would be so easy. And in each of these instances, as an outsider, you could say, oh, it'd be quite easy to protect yourself. And yet the scripture seems to call us beyond that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that your moment in history is governed by the internal life you've lived with God.
Darius the Mede is astounded.
Yeah.
And he comes to his rescue in the end.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you, Jody and Dave, and to Abby Wissing this week. My name is Matilda Fryer.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.